Now, how are we? For those of you who are new here, this is the Inside Trail podcast, where, you know, I get to chat to various different people about various different things, and it's a bit of crack. So to start, I have a little list of things that we need to go over today. So the first thing that I wanted to show you was the video that I just showed you there, Him Barbershop, located on Moby Road. Just where Grift Avenue meets Ballymun Road. I've been getting my haircut there for like 5 years now, and the lads are actually gents, and they do a great barnet as well. So get yourself in there. There's a giveaway of a free haircut and a gift set on at the Inside Trail Pod Instagram. So get on there, enter it, and the winner of that will be announced in a couple of days. So yeah, but we did, Kev Hughes, my man, the wizard behind the lens, did a video, so that's the one that you've just seen, so hope you enjoyed that. Also, something else that I want to say, a couple of weeks ago, I've been kind of swamped with everything, but I did launch my website, which is www.theinsidetrail.com, which will have all the podcasts, little spews from me, but it's also got a section called Real Men Talk, and Real Men Talk is blog posts from anonymous men who wanted to, you know, share their experiences with mental health and times they went through struggles or stuff like that. Now there's 8 posts there now, so if you'd like to help, you know, on working on the stigma of mental health, you know, send your, I'm the only person who will know who it is, so send it, email it to me at theinsidetrail@gmail.com, and I'll put it up there. And you know, maybe someone else who is in your position now, you know, maybe you went through it 2 years ago, maybe that'll help them on dealing with this next step, you know. So, you know, we can help each other out. Real Men Talk, yeah, that's that. Next one, float tanks. I've been doing float tanks / deprivation tank for like, I've done like 5 of them now, and I really, really enjoy them. They're good for headspace, good for, you know, thinking about everything, and hopefully I'm gonna have a discount code for the listeners to go, and I use one in Malahide. I will link that. It's a Float Malahide, which is really, really good. The lads in there are dead sound. And I'll think, I got a lot of questions about it on the Instagram the other day, and I think I'll do a proper piece on float tanks again. But for now, just that there is something coming. I'm working on it, so just leave it with me. But for today's podcast is with Keith Duffy, and we chat about, you know, his time in Boyzone, his new you know, tour with Brian McFadden, which is Boys Life, where they combine all their years in their respective bands in Boyzone and Westlife, and they bring them together, and they seem to have a great crack doing it. And you know, they're back on tour now doing it again. I just got Keith there 3 weeks ago, and we sat down for a chat. I've actually known Keith for about 10-12 years, and great man. But you know, he talked about his love for theater. We chat about, you know, friends, loyalty, all that kind of stuff, and it was really, really good chat. So I hope you enjoy the pod. If you're new here, make sure you subscribe, tell your friends, maybe share it, do something like that, I don't know. But Yeah, let's jump straight in. Bam, bam, bam.
This is the Inside Trail.
Oh, cheers.
Cheers.
It's great to have it.
Anything else about jellies?
Just a bit of sugar to keep you awake, Dan, you know what I mean?
Well,
I wasn't sure if you'd put me to sleep or keep me entertained, so I had to make sure I had every angle covered.
That's why I have the one, sir. So I'll have you stinned up to your eyeballs. So, Keith, the first thing I wanted to start with is boys' life. Because I feel like that's the most current thing for you. So, how did boys' life start?
I was back in 2016. Boyzone were dormant at the time. There was talks of a 25th anniversary tour to come up in 2018. And I had just done 6 months of theatre in London in a Billy Roach play called A Handful of Stars. I've done quite a lot of theatre at this stage now. I did a bit of John B. Keane stuff with Big Maggie.
We went seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, we were in the Gaiety for a while and we came back. I think we did two or three runs of that. And to be honest with you, you know, that's really what I'm passionate about. I love to do straight theatre. I love to kind of get in and create a character and you know, bring the character alive and try and help, you know, help the writer's writing come off the page in my kind of understanding of the character. Not so much, you know, I've done a lot of small screen stuff, limited big screen stuff, but theatre for me is the scariest thing I've ever fucking done.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you've got like a 10-page monologue, they have to go out on stage and just have eyeballs staring at you. You know, when you go on stage as yourself, you have a persona you can hide behind. You know what I mean? It's you, but it's the pop star you, or it's the performer you, but it's still Keith Duffy. When you're going on stage, it's Teddy Heelan, the traveling salesman that John B. King created back in the 70s or 80s or whatever, based in a character in the 50s. You know, he's a very renowned writer. You know, he's a very, very, very well kind of renowned writer, award-winning writer. And many great actors in the past have played the part of Teddy Heelan. So, you know, coming from the pop industry or the music business into theatre, a lot of people would frown upon that. A lot of people would be waiting for me to fuck up. A lot of people would be waiting for me to fall down. So you don't want to put yourself in a headlight like that unless you know you're going to nail it. Unless you know you're going to be fucking good at what you're doing.
Yeah.
And bring something to that character that's never been brought to that character before. Now, I know I'm derailing your question a little bit, but I'll come back around in a minute.
Plenty of
time. So for me, I'm passionate about doing theatre. And you know, and that type of acting, there's not an awful lot of money in it. You know, you're talking barely. You know, if you're from Dublin, for example, and you don't have money in the bank, and you want to do a theatre show in London, you know, you won't be able to afford yourself to do it. You know, you need to get sponsored because a lot of those shows only pay something like between 700 and maybe £1,000 a week. Yeah. But your accommodation in London, you wouldn't be able to live. You wouldn't be able to eat. You know, so I was fortunate enough to be able to afford myself the position to be able to do 6 months of a play, a different play, like I say, A Handful of Stars, a Billy Roach play. And it was set in the recession in the late 70s, early 80s in a pool hall in Wexford. I was playing a character called Stapler, who was a retired boxer. And he was a support lead to the lead character, who was a kind of a retrograde from Wexford, who was, you know, he had a good heart, but he just had a bad nature. You know, he was kind of lost. So my character was there to try and guide him in the right direction, and when he got himself into trouble, to try and get him out of trouble. And it was actually a lovely play. We did 3 months in a fringe theatre, and less than 1% of fringe theatre work gets invited to the West End. So it doesn't fucking happen, because the funding isn't there, it's impossible. So we got an invitation to the West End, to Trafalgar Studios, just off Trafalgar Square, in the smaller room within the theatre. I think it only holds about 120 people, in the half round, which means the audience is all around your performance space. So that's scary, you know. It's scary enough when you're looking at them, but when they're looking at you,
like
balls
from every angle, like
that's, you know, that's heavy tack. But it's that pressure, it's that fear that kind of I get a high off, you know.
going out there every night. Every night's different because you try and find different things with the character that you've created. Your version of the character that you've created, to try and find different ways to play different roles. How to show anger without being aggressive. You know, how to show aggression without being angry. You know, there's all different things you can find within the character, and I really, really enjoyed doing that. And like I said, Boyzone was dormant at the time, and I needed to make money. You know, we all got hit bad with the recession, and I was involved in property and one thing and another, and you know, I got kicked like everybody else, so I had to make sure that I was kind of providing for my family, that I was paying my bills, that I was able to kind of afford the life that we've all become accustomed to. So I had to stay out there and keep working. And I really loved that work, like I said. So when that work, when those 6 months in theatre started to come to an end, I started wondering what I was going to do next. It was 2016. I knew Boyzone would get back together in 2018, but in those couple of years, I wondered what I was going to do. I didn't know, is it the music business? Is it the acting business? I mean, what am I going to do? And I kind of felt to myself at the time that the only thing that I haven't done yet is stand-up or a one-man show. And I think that would be the ultimate difficult job to do. That would be you on your own on the stage in front of all these people. And I kind of thought, okay, I'd love to try that. I'd love to scare the shit out of myself and do this one-man show. So at the time, I was playing around with a few different ideas. Obviously, Jay, my son, who you know, is an actor. And there's a great play that I saw years and years ago called Howie the Rookie, which has recently been done by Tom Von Lawler. Now, it's a two-part show, two monologues. There's Howie and there's the Rookie. And the play basically is one. The Rookie comes out on stage on his own and he does an hour monologue of his interpretation or perception of a night that happened. And the second half of the show is another character, Howie, comes out and he tells his version of how the night happened. Okay. So from his perspective.
Yeah.
So both characters told the same night from their each individual perspective. And then obviously, you kind of in the audience, you kind of see how it was interlinked and how different people could see the same thing differently. And I loved the play when I saw it. A great actor called Carl Shields, God rest him, passed away last year. He was the guy that I saw performing the show originally, and another character, I can't remember his name at the moment. But anyway, I had a thought that it would be a fantastic play for Jay and I to do together. Mm. Jay to play the Rookie and me to play Howie. And I know the guy that wrote it, a guy called Omro Ro wrote the show years ago, wrote the play years and years ago. So I approached him and asked him, what would I need to do to get the rights for Jay and I to do the show? Because, like, it's going back to saying, I wanted to do a one-man show. It's not a one-man show, it's a two-man show, but you're on stage on your own for an hour.
Yeah.
So it's effectively like a one-man show. Now, I'd have a lot more experience in front of an audience than my son Jay would, so it would be really throwing him into the sharks.
Yeah.
You know, he's only going to sink or swim, isn't he? So, and you know, I don't think anybody could be prepared, really, to stand up on stage on their own and do an hour monologue.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work involved in that. But I loved the idea of it. I spoke to Jay, and he kind of, it scared him, I think, a little, but at the same time, he was fascinated to see, you know, how we could play off each other. So I approached the writer and he said, you're not going to believe it. He said, a lady by the name of Anne Clark, who runs a great production company that I've worked for in the past, she had just approached them and got the rights of the play to do it herself. I can't remember the name of her production company, but it doesn't matter. And it turns out that she had decided to bring this play back to life with an actor called Tom Von Lawler, the guy that played Midge in Mulvaney.
Yeah,
But she had an idea to get him to play both parts. So he's going to come out as the Rookie, and he's going to play the Rookie, and then he's going to come back out in the second half, and he's going to play Howie.
Yeah.
Now, that's an amazing feat for any actor to do both parts and to be seen differently. I went to see it, although I hold him in very high regard as an actor, I was disappointed.
Really?
Because I thought, what's the point? This is just an actor's ego, in my opinion.
Mm.
I just thought, we know he's a great actor. He should have just picked one role, either the Rookie or Howie, and let another actor come in and give a different dimension, you know? He played both parts amazingly. I can't criticise his performance. I just think the play needed two actors,
yeah.
You know? It was kind of like, look how big my balls are. Unfortunately, that's what it looked like to me. And like I said, I can't criticise his performance. It was great. But the play in its whole needed two different characters. It was difficult to see past the first character because he's a skinny lad with a bald head.
Yeah. Playing not to a full actor scene.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I was disappointed. But anyway, you know, I would have loved him to do that. So that didn't happen. So it was back to the drawing board. And I was trying to figure out well, what can I do? So I was playing around with ideas, I was writing some stuff down. I've never written a play before, so I didn't know where to start or to finish or the middle. And if you don't have a middle, start and end, you're fucked, right? Yeah. So I was talking to a guy who you know probably well, called, or you've heard of, Des Bishop. He's a stand-up comedian and a very intelligent guy. He's written some fantastic stand-up shows, and ultimately an amazing person. He went and learned how to speak fluent Chinese and did stand-up in China. You know, he's from Boston in America, he's Irish-American, but he went down to Gaeltacht Derry, and I think it was in Limerick, and learned how to speak Irish and did stand-up in Irish. And he'd done all this in small time spaces. You know, I mean, we in Ireland grow up in Irish school. We do 13 years of Irish, and none of us can speak Irish when we leave school.
Fucking crazy.
You know, this guy comes out of the Gaeltacht after a year or 8 months or a year or whatever, and does a stand-up show in fucking Irish. Like, he's quite a clever individual. He was doing another show where he was working in Abacababa, one of these fast food restaurants in town, and a lot of the people that he was working with were from China. So he made some good Chinese friends. That gave him the idea to go out to China, to the place where these guys come from, and learn how to speak Chinese. And he was actually on Chinese TV, speaking Chinese, doing stand-up. Like, he made it really successful. So that's just a little bit of the background on Des, if you don't know Des. He's an amazing guy who I hold in very high regard. I met him in RTE, or we were doing some TV show together or something, and he said, what are you up to? And I said, well, I want to do this, not necessarily stand-up, but I love the whole stage actor performance. I've got to do it, maybe not as myself or as a persona of myself. He said, man, listen, start at the start. He said, you've been on the road for how many years? I said, well, nearly 25 years now. It'll be in 3 years, it'll be 25 years, because this is back in 2016.
Yeah.
And he said, well, look, he said, you must have had some amazing times on the road with the boys. And he said, you must have performed with some amazing people. I said, well, I suppose we did. He said, if you think about it, he said, there must be some great backstage stories that are worthy of you telling. He said, think about it like this. He said, have you ever written an autobiography? And I said, no. He says, well, why don't you do an autobiographical show? So instead of writing a book, talk the book on stage. And show in a couple of hit songs. I mean, how many number ones did you boys have? And I said, I don't know, 9 or something. He said, 9 number one songs. He said, you'd only need 4 or 5 in a show. Not even 4 or 5 if you're not comfortable singing them. Just do 3.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of the stuff in Boys On, I sang back and forth because I didn't sing lead. So I wouldn't have had the confidence. I wouldn't have been given the confidence to sing lead. So I had to kind of, you know, do a bit of rehearsal and get me shit together with that stuff. But nevertheless, he said, like, who have you worked with? You know, and he said, just off the top of your head. I said, well, we worked with Pavarotti. He was a legend, you know. And he said, and where did you perform with him? And I said, over in Modena. He said, what was the audience? He said, 200,000 people, 8 billion people on cable. I said, it was a full orchestra with a 30-piece live band. He said, that must have been amazing. You know, and I said, yeah, it was unbelievable, actually. It was a great night because it was Pavarotti and friends, and the other people on the bill was Joe Cocker and B.B. King and Mariah Carey and Gloria Estefan and Ricky Martin. And he said, geez, man, there must be a great story in that. So there's actually some funny stories because the night before that happened, we played our biggest concert ever in Ireland in Lansdowne Road. The RDS rugby pitch there. I mean, 75,000 people. And I said, that was supposed to be it. We'd been on tour for 2 years. It was our time off the next day. Yeah. Louis Walsh came into our dressing room the night before, and he said, listen, lad, you can't go on your holidays tomorrow. You have to, Pavarotti's sending his private jet to pick you up in the morning, and you're going to fly to Modena in Italy, and you're going to perform no matter what with him live in front of 200,000 people. And we all said no, because we were so shattered and tired. And when tiredness and shit comes in, and a bit of fame, a bit of money comes in, you kind of go, no, listen, we need a holiday. You know, we're going to kill each other. We need a holiday. Ultimately, anyway, there's a really funny story in there. And we went over and we sang with Pavarotti. I was like, there's one of your stories. So then from there we went on, and obviously U2 invited us to be in the Swedish theme video when they shot it going around Marion Square in town, and they had Boys On and Steve Collins, the world champion boxer, and they had Riverdance Michael Flatley, and they had the Fire Brigade out, and it was basically a video that was made for Bono apologising to Ali, his wife, because he missed her birthday, and he was giving her gifts of all these people. So we were like a gift to Ali, but we were doing the back and forth, was that the Swedish thing?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a great story in that. He goes, there you are. He says, you know, put these different things together. And he said, and you have a show. So I put the whole thing together. I wrote the whole show. I kind of didn't know where it was going or what I was doing. I didn't have representation. I'd moved on from any management that I'd ever had before. I had an agent, an actor's agent, really, but they were no good to me. I needed to kind of figure this one out myself. I suppose since 17, 18 years of age, it was the first time I had to come up with a business concept of my own to survive.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing a global deal with the Hilton Hotels. I spoke to some people I knew within the hotelier business, and Hilton Hotels came on touch, and basically I signed a global deal with them to do this performance in their function rooms. So it wasn't going to be, I played obviously with boys, I only play all the big arenas, 15,000, 20,000 a night. I'm going to start playing to 300 people a night now. You know, in the theatres at the acting gig, I was only playing to 80 people some nights, 120 people some nights. So I was used to doing big crowds, small crowds. So a lot of these hotels is 200-300 people, going right up to 1,200 people, depending on the Hilton. So it was coming up to the time to put the tickets on sale, and I was starting to get kind of itchy feet. I was starting to get, you know, what's the expression? Not itchy feet, cold feet. I was starting to get a bit worried, you know?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't itchy feet, it was definitely cold feet. I was worried about the songs. I was worried about the performance of the songs because, like I said, in Boyzone, I was always pushed back. Louis Walsh always introduced me to my heroes as, this is Keith, the one that can't sing, you know? And it's, when somebody tells you that for so long, you start to kind of believe it yourself. So you need to kind of dig deep and get the confidence out and start actually kind of blasting these songs out in rehearsals and finding your voice. So, like I said, I was getting cold feet. I was worried a little bit about that side of it. I was starting to kind of go, oh man, is this the right thing to be doing? Am I going to land flat on my face? So I decided a good idea might be to hire someone to come on the road with me. Like a journalistic kind of person, someone that's going to ask me questions, someone that's going to do a Q&A with me on stage.
Yeah, MC or something.
Exactly, yeah, and I'll get the audience involved maybe that can sing. And we'll duet all the songs instead of doing them on my own.
Yeah.
And I've got a few friends in Dublin that fit the category and that I was considering having a chat to. Anyway, I play golf all over the bloody world. You know, I'm lucky enough to be able to do that with the job that I do. And I've known Brian McFadden from Westlife for nearly 20 years. And in fact, I know him more than 20 years. I know him about 22 years. So I played golf with Brian, and he said he was doing a gig in Whelan's in Dublin. And Brian had kind of left Westlife back in 2004, I think it was. And he went off to live in Australia for 8 or 9 years. And he started writing out there. He had his own solo career. He had 6 number ones in Australia. And then he moved back to Ireland, and he was trying to build his career back up in the UK. And he said he was playing with his live band in Whelan's. And to go from a boy band to playing your own songs with a full live band in Whelan's, like to go from being in a boy band to a rock venue like Whelan's, even though it's a small venue, it's a very credible venue. I was kind of quite impressed with that. So me and a couple of my buddies went in to see him performing, and he blew the roof off the place. He was fantastic. And some of the written songs, his self-penned songs, the lyrical genius, you know, and one's called Irish Sun. It's just a great song, and I was just blown away. I didn't really fully get Brian's talent until that night. And afterwards, as we do, we're having a couple of pints of Guinness, and he was going, "What are you up to at the moment?" And I said, "Actually, I'm putting together this autobiographical show, this one-night show. One, I'm starting to get cold feet, starting to kind of worry about the vocals and stuff like that." And he goes, "Jesus, I'd love to do something like that." And I just went, "Hang on a second, would you like to do it?" I said, "I'll write you in, I'll bring you in on it." I said, "Look, we've both got huge catalogues of back music. I mean, I've got the Boyzone songs, you've got the Westlife songs, you've got the Westlife stories, you've got, you know, you've been married a few times, you've got, you know, you've broken up with your wife, you've broken up with Westlife. I mean, there's plenty
stories in there.
There's plenty stories that we can talk about." And I said, "And some of the Westlife songs are fantastic." So I said, we could really kind of come together on this and make this much bigger than it actually was going to be. And he said, "I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to." So we put the jigsaw together, and it all fitted really, really well. And Brian is a great singer. He had a lot more confidence and experience of lead vocals than I did. So we spent about 4 months in kettles in the hotel function room. Excuse me. We set up our amps and our speakers up there, and we went through all the songs, and I sang all the lead. I had to unlearn Boyzone songs to learn them again. It was easier to learn the Westlife songs because I'd never sang them before.
So you used to sitting in the back of the Boyzone ones?
Well, no, because I'm used to doing the oohs and the ahs and the backing vocals.
Yeah.
I had to unlearn the backing vocals to be able to do the lead vocals. Yeah. And even now on stage from time to time, I've got a lead and Brian's looking at me going, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh shit, I'm singing the backing vocals instead of the lead vocal." But he kind of gave me vocal training for about 3 or 4 months, and my voice came on in leaps and bounds, and we were both as shocked as each other as to how well I was singing now. I was getting much more confident. And so we went out on the road. We put the tickets on sale for the tour. There was a pre-sale of a week in our social media and on our website. So for our members, we put a pre-sale on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock. We were sold out by 10 o'clock. It was unbelievable. We sold the whole tour, right across the whole UK. Sold it out in like 4 hours or something like that. It was 65% sold by 10 o'clock, by 12 o'clock it was nearly done, yeah. And we sold out by the end of the day. It was unbelievable, it was crazy. And we went on tour and we had a fantastic time. And we were finding our feet. The first night we played, I think it was in Liverpool, I'm not sure, I can't remember now. This was back in 2017, April 2017 I think it was. And the first night, we were 3.5 hours on stage.
Really?
And then we realised we can't do that because we've got curfews in all these all these venues. And not only that, people have buses and trains to catch home and the metros to catch home. So if we keep them after 10:30 or 11,
they're fucked.
Like, they have to get a taxi across the portion. So there was a bit of a kickback over that. So we had to bring the show down. We had to shorten the show. And the reason, what happened was, the conference was growing with us when we were doing the stand-up and telling the stories. And of course, you never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So we start off with the basis of story. And we never thought we told lies.
We just kind of padded it out a little bit, yeah. And we started getting carried away.
It's kind of like, button, keep going.
It's kind of like Chinese whispers.
Did you forget to press play?
No, it just cuts out after 20 minutes.
Oh, really? Okay. So the show just went on and on and on. But it was like some of the stories, if we were getting the feedback off the audience that we wanted and we're getting the energy off the audience, we just keep cracking on and we get up off our seats and start acting out these stories now instead of just telling them.
Yeah.
And then we do a couple of songs and then we get into the audience and we get the audience to sing the songs and the show just kind of just took a life of its own. So we toured again, we put on stage again, we sold it again, another autobiographical, and the show was called So Boys Life, obviously Boys on West Life. Boys Life made sense. Now people have asked us, why not West Zone?
Yeah.
And the reason they give them is because there's a fucking car park at the airport in Dublin called West Zone. So we said we'll stick with Boys Life.
Yeah.
So that's how Boys Life was born. That's how it came about. And it's unbelievably exciting. We did four tours. We did two autobiographical tours, which were Stories of Laughter Music 1 and then Story of Laughter Music 2. But then the feedback we got on social media and whatever from our fans were saying, look, we love the stories. We've kind of heard them now. We'd love to hear more of the songs. I mean, between Brian and I, we've 21 number ones in the UK. So that's a phenomenal catalogue of songs.
Yeah.
And our fans want to hear the songs. And now that I'm a lot more confident and, you know, a lot more experienced with the lead vocals, we thought, well, why not do more of a concert now instead of an autobiographical show? So we did a third tour. And we put loads more music in and took the stories out.
Mm.
We literally got rid of all the production that we paid a fortune for. I think whatever the production was, it was a few a few hundred thousand quid. We didn't spend that. We spent $14.99 on a USB stick with the backing tracks, saved ourselves a bloody fortune. And everybody loved it. Nobody gave a shit. So we've done that. We've done two tours like that. And then we toured. We had a tour for 2000 and I think it was the end of 2018. Going into 2019, and the tickets were starting to kind of slow up a little bit, and we were getting a little bit concerned about it. And it was getting to the point where, do we pull the tour, or do we postpone it, or whatever? And then we realised, Westlife, Boyzone, Take That, Backstreet Boys, Spice Girls, were all touring in 2019. Mm. They were all doing reunion tours and anniversary tours in 2019. So their tickets were the hot tickets.
Yeah.
So Boyzone were kind of falling underneath that. So we postponed the tour to the following September, which is September just gone.
Yeah.
And we didn't sell that much more tickets. And we did the tour.
Yeah.
We did every night. We never cancelled a night. Some nights were better than others. But we were kind of wondering, did we come to a natural end of the product that we had created? And then this promoter guy got in touch with us and said, look, you're nowhere near at the end. You've been booking the wrong venues. You know, your fans want to be comfortable, they want to sit down. The gigs we were playing were like the O2 Academy, it's like everybody stand, it's like a rock joint where you have a live guitar and bass and drums, you know, and that's not what we were. So we changed the theatres, like the Gaiety and the Olympia, all across the UK. We put the tickets on sale, and then the first day we sold 65% of the tickets. We're going into rehearsals next week, and it's gone through the roof. It's gone through the roof because we've tripled the size of the venues, and we've nearly sold out now. It's crazy. So we're really excited about it. So we've got a big LED screen going in. We're after auditioning four live musicians. So we've got drums, bass, guitar, and keys. So we've got a full live band behind us now. Big LED screen, and we've gone from there to fucking there. And it's so exciting because I've spent the whole year touring with Boyzone, doing all the big gigs. We've literally done China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, India, UAE, Scandinavia, Europe, Britain. And we finished with five nights in the Palladium in London in October. And we've decided that's it, we're done.
Yeah.
Boyzone will not do another anniversary tour, we're finished. So boys' life then obviously came, you know, came back in. And like I said, this tour that we're about to embark on, we open on the 1st of February in the UK. And it's pretty much nearly sold out right across the board. In fact, we've put another 36 dates on sale for next September and October. And they're going to be going on sale before this tour even starts, which is nuts.
Yeah.
We've got Holland, Norway, Denmark and Sweden all booked up for the festivals during the summer. It looks like we might be doing an American tour in May and April. And then November, December is an Australian New Zealand tour at the end of next year. So it's just gone. It's gone mental. Nuts. It's gone mental. And I love it because, you know, we started off with a USB stick with the backing tracks that we got off the internet. And they were probably like some dodgy karaoke, Asian karaoke backing tracks of our songs. And that's what we were using. But now we've got 8 session musicians from Boyzone. We got them into the studio and recorded our full show live. And we put them on what's called WAV files. So they're very big files kind of shrunken down. But instead of having a backing track of a karaoke song, now we've got a backing track of all our own live musicians, and the sound is awesome, even if we haven't got a live band on stage. So that's what we've been doing. But now I decided, because it's gone so well, we need to bring it up to the next level.
Yeah.
And the next level is get the full live band behind us again. So that's what we've done. We've got a couple of great backing singers coming in, a couple of lovely ladies coming in to do backing singing for us. So, because it's unlike Boys on a Westlife, where everything is harmonies and different level vocals, myself and Brian are singing together as the two leads, so we needed some backing vocals. I said, let's just bring them in. So we've brought them in, and Boys Life now has become a massive entity, and we've just finished recording an album. So we decided that we needed to bring out new material, and then we said, well, hang on a second, it's over 20 years ago since the songs that were number one were produced, and technology has moved on so far in the last 20 years that, think about it, two guys from two of the biggest bands ever out of Ireland, pop groups, so be it, we've all got a shitload of number ones, so we picked 5 of Westlife's top number ones, 5 of Boyzone's top number ones, and we've re-recorded them with the Royal Philharmonic, which is an 84-piece orchestra.
Class.
Right? And we shot it, we recorded it in Abbey Road in London, and the album's coming out now in the next couple of months. But it sounds unbelievable because the songs are already a guaranteed hit. They were already number one.
And they're known as well.
And they're very well known. But now we're bringing them out without the tinny pop production. Now we're bringing them out with an 84-piece orchestra with all the strings and the percussion. They sound, it's like the hair standing on the back of your neck when I hear them. They're difficult to sing to because there's no drums.
Yeah.
So your timing has to be perfect.
Yeah.
So the vocals have got very good, but the timing still needs a bit of work. So I'm a bit nervous about that, and we're only going to do 4 of the orchestra songs in the new tour coming up. We're going to have a live band for the rest, but for 4 songs we're going to just calm it down, spotlight it up, and the two of us are going to do these 4 orchestral songs. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Cool.
But yeah, I mean, look, listen, it was born out of nothing.
Yeah.
I know you asked me a very simple question, and I've taken a half an hour to answer it, but but that's how it was born.
I actually answered so many more things that I would have asked you case of, but one thing that you said, so when you obviously started Boys Life, you said you had to relearn things, like, and you know, take it from a new perspective. Did you then find it hard when you were then back in Boyzone? Was it hard to just jump back in and, you know?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because obviously a big part of my story is the loss of my good friend Stephen Gately. He passed away on the 10th of October 2009, so he's 10 years dead this year, and himself and Ronan did most of the lead vocal, and Shane, Mikey and myself would do the backing vocals. But because I had got so much experience working with Brian doing the lead vocal, doing Boyzone songs, when we went into rehearsals for the Boyzone 25th anniversary show, I said to Ro, I said, listen, I don't want to do the backing vocals anymore. I said, I would like to try and do the lead vocals with you, so whatever part of the song you're happy for me to try, I said, we're in the studio, we've got all the band musicians there, let's try it. And I have to say, Ronan was so up for it, he was so pro me singing with him. So we literally went through song by song, line by line, word by word, let's see what works.
Yeah.
So in the recent Boyzone tour, I actually did lead vocals with Ronan for the whole show. So it was great, it's a funny one, because when you don't have the responsibility of having to do a lead vocal, okay, you can enjoy touring life a lot more.
Yeah.
Because if I party too hard, I lose my voice.
Yeah.
If I'm doing backing vocals with Shane and Mikey, it doesn't really fucking matter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I get by.
Yeah.
But if I'm doing lead vocals,
spotlights,
that means everybody's looking at me. And it means I have to hold the fort for my little bit, my little line, whatever it might be. So you have a responsibility that goes with, that. So for the first time ever in boys' home, like Shane and myself would literally, you know, we would go on tour and we would party till the cats and dogs came home. You know, we would never miss a trick. We would be, every night we come off stage, we get some club in Scotland, in Glasgow, or in Newcastle, or in Bournemouth, and, you know, we put the feelers out that we're playing a gig tonight, and who wants to throw our after-show party for us? And you get these clubs going, look, we'd love to throw you an after-show party. So we'd bring all our boys down there. We'd have bottles of Grey Goose and ice in the VIP room, and we would just have a great time. And that was what touring was for us. All of a sudden, I couldn't be doing that anymore.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I had to go do the show, maybe have a couple of glasses of red wine to kind of calm down, because it's hard when you come off stage to just stop. You know, you're flying, your energy's going, you're through the roof. It's crazy exciting. It's just, you cannot slow down. Your adrenaline just keeps pumping. So you go for a couple of glasses of red wine and just let yourself just unwind, and you've got to be in bed by, 1 o'clock, half one.
It's not the early hours of the morning that you
used to be. No, I remember at times myself and Shane, we're sitting in the lobby of a hotel because the bar kicked us out at 5, and we're still sitting drinking cans of Foster's in the lobby of a hotel with the dancers, and Ronan be giving out the lift going to the gym, after having a full night's sleep. So, things changed, but they changed for the better, because I'm 45, I'm not 22 anymore. Mm. So, you don't get away with that anymore. It's okay when you're in your 20s and 30s, when you're a little bit wild,
yeah.
You know, you're kind of living life or whatever. When you get into your 40s, there is a kind of an unspoken rule that you have to have a little bit more kind of responsibility.
Mm.
So getting up to sing the lead vocals gave me the ability to understand that and to force myself to try. At least try to get to bed early. And I would reward myself, because we'd only ever do 4 shows in a row.
Yeah.
You'd only ever do Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then you'd have 2 nights off.
Yeah.
Or a night, not 2 nights, 1 night off. It's called a travel day, but a lot of bands do 5 or 6 nights in a row. Our rule is 4 nights in a row.
Yeah.
So after the 4th gig, I can let my hair down that night, because I have a day off and I can sleep all day the next day and rest my voice. So that's what I tended to do.
Yeah.
So I meant, instead of partying every night, I was only partying every 4 nights.
Yeah.
But I still had a party. Still had a good time. But to be honest, I really, really enjoy and love now being, feeling a lot more part of the performance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's why I love the acting so much, because it was me.
Yeah.
It was me doing it. There was nobody else doing it for me. There was nobody sharing the responsibility. It was me on my own, and I needed that responsibility, having been in the band for so many years, sharing everything. Coming back to me and Brian, and Brian and I, there's only 2 of us, so there's still a great deal of responsibility. I mean, I feel like what I'm bringing to the table needs to be there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I'm not just filling a void.
No.
I'm actually making a space.
You know, just saying, and I, you're actually.
Yeah, I'm out there, and I hit a bum note, and I know, and over the last 3 years of performing with Brian, the fans have followed us for 26 years, so they know how much I've done in the past. It's the same faces everywhere you go.
Yeah.
I mean, the front line of a concert every time.
Yeah.
You've grown up with them all. You know, I know them 25 years.
Yeah.
So they know how much I've worked, how much I've come on, how the effort I've put in, and then they wait to see if I'm going to hit that line out. And then if I do, you can see them go, oh, thank God for that.
Yeah.
They're on my side.
Yeah,
they're not looking to see me fall down. They're looking to see me, excel.
Come on,
So, so it's good. So, I'm really, really excited about this tour now. I'm in the gym, I'm training, I'm getting fit.
Yeah.
It keeps you young.
Absolutely.
So, boys' life has a huge future ahead. Especially, like I said, I've already got about 125 dates booked in across the world for next year, and that's even without the new album, which was supposed to be coming out for Mother's Day, but I think we're going to put it back from May.
Okay.
But that should be very interesting. An orchestra with Brian and I. Doing songs that were already hits.
Yeah.
It could be, we could go to the next level again now.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. It's very exciting. One of the things that I want to ask you is something that you've always, I've always heard you talk about, like privately to us about, is like the importance of like your close circle and friendship and stuff like that. And obviously when you're in, the public eye for 25 years, you have people who just aren't genuine people. But how do you, how do you keep a close circle and, keep the loyalty with people around you?
Well, that is very, very difficult, because we're all human, we all fall down from time to time. Loyalty and friendship, at the end of the day, there's an old saying going that you can count all your real friends on one hand.
Mm.
And it's true. And when the chips are down and life is difficult, you really do find out who your friends are.
Mm.
in the business, you do get a lot of people. Look, I've seen it so many times because my career over 26 years has gone like that and then like that. Mm. My profile, let's say, for example, you know, my familiar face will be so familiar and then not familiar.
Yeah.
It goes down to your favorite table in the restaurant is always there for you while you're going like that. But when you're going like that and you're ringing up, sorry, we've no room tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it so many times. So you kind of, you grow out of that and you stop giving a shit about that.
Yeah.
But it's 100% true that, you know, when you're climbing, people are all over you. When you're falling, they don't know you. Yeah. So you've got to have it. You've got to have an inner sanctum. You've got to have a great circle of friends. You know, and a lot of my friends I've had since I was growing up. You know what I mean? And I suppose I'm lucky in the sense that I met my wife very young and we had my son Jay very young. So I had a lot of responsibility on me in a boy band at a very young age.
Yeah.
You know, so whereas the other boys were going off to Vegas and running amok and having a great time, you know, I was at home with a wife and a child.
Yeah.
And although at the time I probably would have looked to be in Vegas, looking back on it now, I'm kind of glad because it gave me a huge amount of understanding of reality and grounding and stuff like that. And, you know, the Irish mammies of the world keep their sons kind of grounded. Well, they do their best, you know. We all fly the nest at one stage, but, you know, when the foundation is there, you know, the walls can be knocked down, but they can be built back up because the foundation is strong, you know. And unfortunately, you do meet people that are not sincere, you know. They blow smoke up your arse. They want to be your friend. It's like, you know, when you've been in the business as long as I have, you've got bands like One Direction coming out. Obviously, when they came out back in the day, you know, we were the older group. And, you know, you've got journalists saying to you, know, what advice would you give to Niall Horan, or what advice would you give to One Direction, you know? And I've met all the boys. And when you're 18 or 19 years of age and you're taking over the world and you're the biggest thing on social media and you're the biggest thing in the music business, you're not going to listen to an old guy like me telling you what you should and shouldn't do.
Yeah.
You know it all yourself. And that's just a human trait.
Mm.
You know, when we're 22, we think we know it all. It's only when you're 42 you realise that you knew fuck all. But nobody can tell you that.
Yeah.
It's a life experience. You've got to learn for yourself. You know, I know when I was 20, I thought I knew it all. When I was 21, I thought, you know, I have this sussed. And then you go through years of realizing, my God, I was so naive. I thought I knew it all and really knew nothing. And it's only when you get to, like, when you get into your 40s, especially, like, I'm 46 this year, and it's only now that I'm really kind of seeing, you know, the error of my ways, let's say. And thankfully, there isn't too many extreme ones. But, you know, I've made mistakes over the years. Of course I have. Everybody does. Most of them were made while I was drunk, by the way. There was very few when I was sober. But there's, nevertheless, the mistakes have been made. And listen, the mistakes you make carve you out to be the person that you're going to be for the rest of your life. So I don't regret anything I've done because it's made me who I am, and I'm very, very kind of at peace with who I am now, and I enjoy my life. But unfortunately, to answer your question, there's a lot of people out there that are insincere.
Mm.
You know, it took me a great long. I don't have my natural train of thought is genuinely kind.
Mm.
But there's people out there that natural train of thought is mean, and they, you know, they're just trying to get one up on you.
Yeah.
You know, there's people out there that they're just not nice people. You know, they will ascertain what you can provide for them emotionally and financially, and they will exhaust every avenue trying to get what they want from you while telling you how wonderful you are. You know, and in this business, there's a great deal of insecurity. People need to be reassured all the time, okay? Because when you're on stage in front of fucking thousands of people every week, you do become quite self-aware, you know, of your traits, good and bad.
Mm.
So a little bit of reassurance from people that you care about is always nice. So you get these people that are giving you the reassurance that you want, but they're not necessarily sincere with it.
Yeah.
But you don't give a shit because it's playing to your ego and it's making you feel better.
Yeah.
But while you're doing that, they're ascertaining what they can gain from you. Like, whether it be, like I say, financially, socially, psychologically.
Yeah.
You know, and when they exhaust those avenues and get what they want, they just treat you like a piece of shit, you know? You're like a bit of shit at the end of their shoe.
Yeah.
And you're only human, and probably insecure.
Yeah.
So that can fucking hurt.
Yeah.
And that happens to a lot of people in the business that have a heart, that care.
Yeah.
You know, now you get people in the business that are as clever psychologically as these people.
Yeah.
They see them coming, and they fuck them off.
Yeah.
You know, and I suppose now, I would pride myself on having been hurt.
Yeah.
And probably used in my more kind of younger, immature years. I would kind of pride myself now on not being kind of carried away by these people too much. Yeah. You know,
you're probably more dead wild about picking the people that you let in.
Yeah, but it's not even picking. The way it is, nobody gets in anymore.
Yeah.
I don't need anybody.
Yeah.
You know, I have enough friends. I don't need anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I need to meet new people because I'm working on new projects and I need to meet people that know what they're doing better than I do so they can educate me.
Yeah.
So you do have, and you might get on well with some people, you might have a lot in common with some people, but my attitude is the same. I don't need any new friends. I'm here to do business.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be rude or obnoxious, or I'm going to be very friendly and courteous and mannerly, but don't think there's a friendship here. This is a fucking work thing, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the way I've had to be. I mean, because with the boys' life thing, we had got management in the early days.
Yeah.
But soon after we started to kind of move on, we realized the management weren't for us.
Yeah.
So we parted ways, and I've managed the whole project on my own since then. I've done everything, from booking the gigs to buying the clothes for touring, for you name it, I've done everything myself. Cool. You know, Brian likes to play golf.
Yeah.
And like I said, he's one of the most talented guys I know. He's a great singer-songwriter, but he's not interested in the day-to-day shit.
The running,
you know, he doesn't know how that happens. Yeah. He doesn't realise. I think when he says he does realise, you know, he says, Duster, I know you're on the phone 8 hours a day, you know, getting us ready. But literally, I have managed the whole thing myself. I've put it together. I've made the calls. I've realised over the years...
No, you can keep going.
I've realised over the years that a lot of the people, the people, the artists themselves, can get a bad reputation or name, not because they're rude or nasty people, because the people, their entourages, as they're known, the people around them are rude and nasty.
Mm.
And like a manager, a security guard, an artist liaison, they're the people that they're the front line before you get to the band. So the people that meet them on your behalf, you know, they can be fucking rude to them. I've seen it. I've seen guys that I hold in very high regard, friends of mine who work for me, and they're very mannerly and nice people. And when they might not know that I'm standing in earshot around the corner when they're meeting or greeting somebody, and I've heard that they speak to these people, like they have this air of authority.
Yeah.
And they're really enjoying this air of authority because they're working for the band directly. And I pull them up and go, man, what way did you talk to that person? Yeah. Oh, I said, no. Yeah. You're representing me. I would never speak to someone like that. So I'd appreciate it if you don't. So this type of thing kind of played in my head. I said, they're representing me, but they're using this air of authority to talk down to people because they want to meet me and he's the man in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, not saying that that's the person, but just saying there's people that work for you sometimes that don't, you know, respect how courteous you are to people when you meet them directly. So nobody can represent you better than yourself.
Yeah.
So I just thought, for now, I'm going to represent both of us, Brian and I, until we get to where we need to go. So there was about 5 different agencies that want to book their gigs, and they all wanted exclusivity.
Yeah.
And I said, listen guys, I'm new to this. I'm 25 years in the business, but I'm new to doing the dealings and the wheelings.
Mm.
So I said, I don't know who's sincere and who's not. So please don't be taking any disrespect from me. I want to work with you, but I don't know who you are. You can promise me the sun, moon, and stars. You can blow smoke up my arse.
Yeah.
But facts are facts. So whoever kind of provides me with what I need, the best and the most efficiently, are the people that I want to work with, you know? So like I said, there's about 5 different agencies, and I worked with them all. And like I said, there was some better than others. Some guys go, we want the exclusivity, you can't be diluting the market with everybody saying they represent you. You need to have one person representing you or you're going to fuck up and that. I said, listen, that's my problem.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to work with you. You get me a gig, I agree the price, we'll do the gig, right? And nobody gets exclusivity, not at least for 12 months. So that's exactly what I did. And organically, 12 months to 15 months, it turns out now, 2 years in, we've got one guy left.
Yeah.
I've gradually gone through them all.
Whittled them down.
I whittled them all down, yeah. And this one guy kept being honest and true to his word. And he's not perfect, neither am I, but we work very, very well together. And organically, without contracts, with nothing, he has exclusivity on us now.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say some guy won't ring me up in the morning and go, listen, I've got a massive concert for you in Vietnam. Here's the fee, there's the flights, bang, 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 it's coming. But out of respect, now what I do is I go, okay, we want to do that gig, it's great. But Andy, my agent, he's got to do the contracts on it. So I give him his percentage, even though it's something to do with him. I could cut him out of the loop completely, but, you know, it's short-sighted.
Yeah.
You've got to look at the big picture.
Yeah.
So now that he's kind of become exclusive, I invite him in to do the gigs that have nothing to do with him. And it's like scratching people's backs, you know.
Definitely.
So it's that, you know, to answer your question, you know, you do become very, very aware of the people that are not sincere.
Yeah.
And you've got to try your best to stay clear of them. You can't give advice to guys coming up through the business because they believe they're the first people to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you might have done everything that they're about to do, but they don't see it like that.
Yeah.
They think you're a has-been. I watched something recently. I was watching the Michael Hutchins documentary recently, and the Brits were on, and like INXS were such a massive band. They were huge. They were great. I mean, you two and INXS were kind of pitching with each other. Michael Hutchins and Bono. And you know, unfortunately, I saw the documentary tonight, and Michael Hutchins had to fall off a bike and got brain damage that he never told anybody about, and it changed his whole demeanor, changed his whole personality, not for the better.
Yeah.
And his life just went on a kind of a downward spiral from then, and ultimately INXS, well, Michael actually took his life, and then INXS broke up. But I was watching, as he was coming back with his new album and things were going well, he was on the Brits and he was awarding the best new artist, and it was Oasis, and Noel Gallagher went on stage to pick up the award from Michael Hutchins, and he said in the microphone, "Why are you getting a has-been to award the new being?" You know, and it devastated Michael Hutchins at the time. And it's just like, wow, it's so bitter and twisted, this business. You know, there's no need. I mean, Michael Hutchins was a serious singer-songwriter. Why would Noel Gallagher be so publicly rude to him, you know?
Yeah.
In my opinion, there's no need for that shit, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I suppose we're going to move on to our segments, where I'll have you here till Sunday. So the first round of things is just going to be just kind of random questions, right? So the first thing is someone who inspires you.
Someone who inspires me. Well, the first person that comes to mind is a guy called Paul Bourne. Paul Bourne owns a business in Ireland called Body Bourne.
Yeah.
He's a personal trainer. I started working with Paul back in 2007 when Boyzone had been away for 7 years and they were coming back for the first time. I was quite overweight, probably 3 or 4 stone overweight. I didn't realise I was. I thought I looked gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it was only when I went to the gym and done one session I realised how unfit I was. But it wasn't just the personal training. It was the life coaching. It was the nutrition. It was the positive mental attitude. It was just, we've become great, great mates, and we're still great mates now, moving on, whatever, it's 12 years. But he inspires me. I mean, the guy, he's 50, 51 years of age. He was, back in his day, he was a judo and karate world champion. He lived in Japan teaching karate and judo. He speaks fluent Japanese. I didn't know any of this at the time. I only found out this over our lifetime together. Paul went on then, he was a bodybuilder, and he won Mr. Ireland, Mr. Northern Ireland, Mr. Universe, and he was a big pumped up bodybuilder. Then he was always doing personal training. He steered away from the bodybuilding, went more to the men's fitness and ladies' fitness and stuff like that. He got his own studio in town, and ultimately now he's a big 3,000 square foot personal training studio on Clarendon Street in Dublin. And he's got quite a few trainers working for him now. He's done very, very well. But over the time of me knowing him, coming into the recession, I was doing a lot of fundraising for children with autism. I have a daughter, Mia, who has autism. And there was not many services available to us as a family for Mia at the time, or for any kids with autism at the time. So we tried to do our bit, and we started up a charity. I worked for a charity called Irish Autism Action, and we've done some great work, and we brought some great education facilities into Ireland. But we've done black tie balls and golf events and so forth. But when the recession kicked in, the funding was gone, and we needed to come up with new ideas. So Paul suggested that we start doing fitness kind of things, like 5K run. We started off with a 5K run. Ultimately, we ended up in Ironman.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I never swam or cycled in my life, and all of a sudden I'm doing
that. They're heavy tech.
I've done 3 Ironmen. I've done about 50 Olympic triathlons. I've done 7 marathons, and Paul has done every one of them side by side.
Really?
Every one of them side by side. That's not always a good thing, by the way.
Yeah.
Our first triathlon was an Olympic triathlon in Skerries, and both of us wear glasses, both of us are blind as bats, and we didn't realise you can actually get your prescription put into your goggles. And we started on the beach in Skerries, and we did go out under this kind of inflatable arch, and you have a tag on your foot that tells you what you're doing, measures your fucking thing or whatever. So, two of us were swimming together. I could look, you see him, he looked, you see me. We kept going, We swam to this buoy that we thought we had to do in the middle of the water. But we looked up, we'd gone about 400 metres the wrong way. So then we had to swim all the way back to the other end of the beach, back out of the water. So when we come back out of the water, we're the last out of the water. Because we obviously went the wrong way. But there was a lot of people running to get on their bikes. And Paul's going, no, 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 we have to do another lap. And I said, why? He said, they're doing the sprint, we're doing the Olympic. And I'm going, what's the sprint? I thought a triathlon is a triathlon is a triathlon. He goes, oh, no, no, there's two different distances. The sprint is a much shorter one than the Olympic. And I said, well, why the fuck are we not doing the sprint? We've never done this before. Yeah. Surely we'd start there and build our way up. He goes, oh, no, no, we're too fit for that.
Yeah.
We're doing the Olympic. I thought, you fucker. So we went to get down, back under the arch again, do the whole lap again. We didn't get lost this time.
Yeah.
And we get on the bike, last two bikes in the rack. We get the bikes out, flying down through Skerries, down the hill. The marshal in the high vis vest is supposed to tell you where to go. You know, we come to a T junction, he's supposed to kind of go that way or that way. He's texting on his phone and we're flying down. And I'm screaming at the guy, what way, left or right? Because I'm trying to catch up some time. And last minute he went like that. So I kind of back braked into the corner, hit a fucking pothole, got two punctures, front wheel and the back wheel. I haven't changed a tube since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how to do it, but Paul had all the stuff in his bag. He stopped with me. We changed the two tubes and the two tyres, back on the bikes and off we go. We came in last. It was our first triathlon, we came in last. We did Holt's 2 weeks later, and I think we were way up near the front on the second one. And we went on to do loads of them after that. But he climbed Machu Picchu with me, went on the Inca Trails for 6 nights.
He did Mount Elbrus, just gone.
He did, yeah. Like I was supposed to do it with him, and I had to pull out last minute because of work. But I mean, he's unbelievable. To go to being a bodybuilder shape, to being an athlete and running marathons and doing triathlons, and he's changed his body type so many times. And then he entered Mr. Universe last year without telling anybody in the bodybuilding. He's the president of NABA, the National Amateur Bodybuilding Champions or whatever. He's like the boss of Ireland and Europe as well, I think. And he told nobody. He just entered in the over 50s in the fitness, and he came fourth. He got placed in the Universe, like in the fitness and the swimwear fitness, not as a bodybuilder. Yeah. Completely different shape body. Like he's just, you know, you're saying he inspires me. That man, for more reasons than 10, he inspires me.
That's good. And what is the most useless thing that you know how to do?
The most useless thing that I know how to do. Well, it's useless to me. To the trained ear, I can't do anything. But to the untrained ear, I look like I'm a great drummer, and it's useless to me.
You actually are a good drummer. I've heard for his
play. Like I said, to the untrained ear.
Very fair. Okay, let me give you one more of these. If you could only learn one magic spell and do something mundane and boring, what would you do?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, if you have the ability to do that, it wouldn't be mundane and boring. Yeah. Right? That would be the most exciting thing ever.
The other one is just like, oh, I'll, you know, make it a lot of food. Or like, you know, I was thinking, you know, make your bed. That's what my head done, you know?
Okay, well, no, I never do shit like that. Somebody has to do that for me.
Oh, well, look at you.
I'm joking. I made you bed this morning. Yeah. If I walk out, if whoever's last in the bed, whether it be my missus or me, you know, she'd make it. But listen, if I get out of bed and I don't make it, I get an earful. Yeah. So I make me bed.
You're well trained.
Mundane thing. Get me out of bed and get me in the gym.
Yeah.
The motivation to get out of bed and go to the gym on a day off. You know what I mean? That's the hardest thing in the world for me to do. Because, you know, I watch TV in bed. Another reason for that is I don't like upsetting the sofa downstairs because my wife likes the sofa being puffed and clean. And I don't want to mess that around. So it's easier to stay in bed and watch TV in bed. To go from there, watching Netflix or whatever I'm watching, to get from there into my sports gear. And like, we live beside a gym, we live across the road from the gym. It's easy, most people have a lot harder than we do. And I just find it difficult. So if I get something mundane and boring, get me out of the bed and just put me in the gym. There you go.
Okay, so your life hack. So something that you do or that you think other people could benefit from.
I suppose the one thing that I've always kind of, that's helped me along the way, from good times and bad, because everybody has a perception of how other people are doing, but nobody ever knows what goes on between the 5 inches between people's ears. You know, and in the life that we're living today, you know, we're this whole thing now about mental health and being aware of mental health and you know, breaking the silence and coming forward and don't be ashamed and don't be embarrassed about having problems. And you know, I've lost a couple of friends through their mental health, and it's terrible. When you have hours and hours to think about, you know, what could you have done to help and prevent them from you know, losing their lives because of mental health. You know, there's a million ways you can talk about this. I mean, the world that we're living in today, people are making their voice heard, and it's great because it's taken away any kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, they're taking away any kind of negativity when it comes to voicing your opinion of mental health. And it's helping people that suffer with depression or whatever being able to come forward and saying, especially young men, you know, they're saying in our society it's mostly men in their, in, you know, in their early to late 20s, early 40s. They're the ones that kind of, I suppose.
The highest killer in young men over 40 and
there you go.
Highest.
And, you know, it's for me, everybody can get down this, you know. Unfortunately, because it's been broadcast so loud now, I do believe there are people that are not chemically depressed, or people that might have down days like we all do, but they're clinging on to the fact now that they're suffering from mental health.
Mm.
And they're taking away from the people that genuinely
have
mental health issues, people that generally have anxiety, that suffer anxiety attacks, that can't control their attacks when they come on them, and they, you know, they're going out Friday and they're worried about, will their phone die before they get home? Will they have enough money to get a taxi? What if somebody spikes their drink? What are they going to wear? Are they going to look fat in what they're wearing? You know, or maybe they might get into a row. Maybe this, you know, and all of a sudden they've got 10 things going through their head on Friday night, that it comes to Friday morning, oh, I'm not going out tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and they're living their life like that, and that's horrible. That shouldn't be the way. And I suppose the point I was getting to, everybody has down days. Some people suffer from depression. Some people, like I say, suffer from anxiety. Something that I've always believed helps me, and can help people if you believe it, you know, positivity, positive mental attitude,
yeah.
PMA, you know, being positive about everything that you do. Whether it's in the gym and you're looking at a weight and you're saying to yourself, oh, no, I'm not going to do that, I won't be able for that.
Yeah.
And you're talking yourself out of it before you try it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying injure yourself by taking out 40 kilo dumbbells.
Yeah.
In the gym, it's not about the weight, it's about the resistance of your own body. So you shouldn't give a shit what anybody else is thinking of. Like, lift up a 2 kg weight if that's what enough for it. I mean, I'd love to be able to just get my workout done with a 2k,
yeah.
but I'm not getting enough resistance.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's having the positivity to tell yourself, yes, I can.
Yeah.
Yes, I will. Yes, I can. Positive mental attitude. Your subconscious listens to your conscious.
Yeah.
So when you say you can't do something, your subconscious has listened to that.
Yeah.
And when you come back to it, your subconscious is going to relay that back to you, saying,
yeah.
no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's up to you to cheat your subconscious.
Yeah.
Even if you believe or think you can't do something, say out loud that you can. I can do that.
Yeah.
I will do that. And when it comes around again, your subconscious will say, you can do this. You will do this.
Yeah.
And the difference that makes to people's lives is amazing. You know, it's something we do every day without even realizing it. Oh no, I can't. Oh no, I won't. Oh no, I don't want it. And it's negative, negative, negative. If we could turn all the negatives into positives, and like I say, even if we don't believe it, say it out loud. Convince our subconscious that we can. Lie to ourselves. Because it's like confidence. What is confidence? You can be very insecure. You can be very shy. But you can pretend not to be by being overconfident. But it's an act. You act that act long enough, your subconscious will think that you are confident, and you forget you were ever insecure, and it'll happen organically without you even realizing. Do you understand?
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
You know, confidence drives confidence. So even if you don't believe you're confident enough to do something, pretend to be confident enough. Play that role. Act it out. Pretend to be that confident. Your subconscious will see that, listen to it, and you believe it. So all of a sudden, he's feeding you the confidence that you need to do it. And you wake up one day, and you are that confident person.
Yeah.
We'll all get down days, like I said.
Yeah.
Of course we do, we're human, but none of us are perfect.
Yeah.
But if we could try and be a little bit more positive in everything that we do, and we try to instill PMA into everybody that we meet, you know, a solid handshake when you meet someone. How are you doing?
Yeah.
Walk into a room and be proud of who you are. It's okay to be shy, that's fine. But as long as you're aware of it, and if you're happy being shy and being quiet, well fine, it works for you. But if it's something that's getting you down, you need to overcome that. You need to find a way to be a better version of yourself. And PMA is the root and the start of all those problems, I think, you know?
It's actually funny, I don't know, I must have heard you talk about this before, because that was one of the questions, was positive mental attitude.
Okay.
So it's actually funny that's obviously something that is in you.
Well, it's in me. There was a good friend of mine, who we all know, Brendan O'Carroll, Mrs. Brown's boys. He's the guy.
More time, keep going. And yeah.
Brendan O'Carroll, Mrs. Brown's boys. I mean, Jay was an actor when he was in one of Mrs. Brown's boys' original kind of tapes, when he was 7. Or something like that. It's very funny to watch. Look back, and he was tiny, wearing a baseball cap backwards, and he had a speech impediment or something close to it at the time. There was a guy dressed up as a chicken, and he runs over these little Dublin, little north side Dublin heads, you know, Hey, why did the chicken cross the road? To get to, because he was a dope or something like that. We watched it recently and broke our heart laughing at it, you know. But like, I mean, everything, like Brendan's been a part of our life for a long, long time, and that's what I was saying, like, that's how far back we go with Brendan. But Brendan always instilled positive mental attitude in everybody that he met, and he believes in himself.
Yeah.
And he wrote that show over 25 years ago for radio. And now, I mean, the guy, I remember in 2009 I met Brendan in Florida, and things weren't going too good for him. He said, listen, you know, financially things are not great, Duster. But he said, BBC are coming out to meet me here in Florida on Wednesday, and they're not coming out to give me bad news.
Mm.
So he says, I think there's good news coming. And that's when Mrs. Brown's Boys was born for the BBC, and then RTE took it, and they went on from series to series, and now they got the musical.
Really,
and the movie, he's grossed, I would hate to stagger a guess, of over 50 million, I'd imagine now. You know, he's done amazingly well. And that was just belief in himself and positive mental attitude and talent, obviously, but believing in his own talent, even when other people are going, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, Brendan has changed, like, he's done the way he wanted to do it on his terms. And it can be done. See, believe and achieve, you know, and I believe that to be true. If you see and believe it, and then you go and achieve it. So it's a huge thing, it's a huge practice to keep in your life regardless of what you're doing. And never let the fact, like you always say this, there's going to be haters, there's going to be lovers. You know, the haters will always hate and the lovers will always love. If you can change the haters to be a lover, well then you're doing a great job. But that's not your job, that's not what you're set out to do. You're out to do what you believe you can do, and let the sky be the limit with that.
Well, that's. I think that might be one of the better life hacks we've had on here. Because sometimes it's, you know,
too deep.
No, definitely not. But like sometimes it's a, you know, it's a Revolut card or it's a.
Oh, right, okay.
But so like that's actually something that I do think a lot of people do need to be a lot more aware of. And as you said, it's something that if you can trick yourself into doing it, and as you said,
but that's it. It's cheating yourself.
Yeah.
Because you spend so much time when you know you can't do something thinking about it, but if you pretend that you can and put that into action. Not only that, you will see it working, you will understand it a lot more, and you will recognise it in other people that you might care about. And if you recognise something that you've suffered and achieved better in somebody that you love and care about, you might be able to help them get to where you got to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like a chain reaction, it's like a pyramid system. You know what I mean? But the pyramid will keep growing, it won't fall down.
Yeah.
You know? When we deal with our own insecurities and problems, we think we're the first people in the world to ever suffer from that. The reality is people all around are suffering the same problems. If we were to deal with our own problems one at a time and better ourselves, then we can recognise the same problems in other people and try and help them too. And that's PMA.
Absolutely. Okay, so your trivia now, right? So, Jay, what did you get when you did the trivia? What? Five? Yeah, was it five?
You said three at the start.
I thought it was three.
All right, we'll see. Well, we come back and check that out.
Yeah, yeah, we'll check afterwards.
Because he was probably Googling it under his lap.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, so...
and my life hack was a Revolut card, you prick.
Yeah, it was.
the fucking shallow bastard.
Okay, so your first one. Cashmere is made from fur of what animal?
Cheap.
Close, a goat.
Here
we go, the judge in the corner now. Where is the Bridge of Sighs?
The Bridge of Sighs?
Yeah.
Where is the Bridge of Sighs? I've absolutely no idea, but I stagger a guess. China?
Venice.
Okay. Well, actually, now it makes sense, doesn't it?
How many UK number one singles had Bob Dylan?
Six.
Zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not looking good for even three now.
Well, you've got ten, so it's still time. In Roman mythology, who's the god of the sun?
Zeus.
Apollo. Who is the longest serving president of the USA?
Obama got two sittings, so that was 8 years, I think.
This particular president somehow has longer than two, so it's a bit of...
It's not Lincoln, is it?
No, it's Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jesus, this is looking great.
Okay.
How many of them would you have got right?
Three so far.
Yeah. Which one would you have
got? I knew that one. I knew Bob Dylan. And I knew the first match.
Okay, right, well. The next one gets
wrong. Just take my word for that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The next one gets wrong. I'm going to ask you. In plants, what is the name for burning sugar to make energy within the plant? So what do plants do to make energy?
They breathe oxygen. They breathe out oxygen. They breathe in nitrogen and out oxygen.
Yeah, and what's that process called?
Fuck no. What's it called?
Photosynthesis. No, it's respiration. They're making energy.
Oh, just see what you said though.
Yeah, okay, so which theoretical physicist and author of A Brief History of Time was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the USA?
Fucking Einstein.
No, I'll give you the point. A theoretical physicist.
Is he your man in the wheelchair?
Yeah. Oh, what's his
name? What's his name now? What's his
name? He nearly died there last year.
Yeah.
Oh fuck, what was his name? I just watched his movie the other day. I mean, listen, I know who it is.
Yeah, right. Stephen Hawking, right?
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah. What is the heaviest weight class in professional boxing?
Heavyweight?
Yeah. Some people say super heavyweight, so there's two of them. The ossicle bones are found in what part of the human body?
The ossicle.
Ossicles.
Ossicles. The foot?
Ear.
What?
The ear?
What?
What? Which Scottish DJ was born Adam Richard Wiles in January 1984?
Oh, fuck your man, that got all ripped up and looks great now. What's his name? He does fucking work with loads of different artists. Am I right?
Yeah.
Well, like, what's his name? Shit. I'm not even, there's no real fucking TV cameras on me now. Like, I won the chase, you know. What's his name? Jesus Christ. I can't remember. Mine's a blank.
Calvin Harris.
Yeah. Look, I listened to him every fucking time. I got 2 out of 10.
I'll give you 0.5 because you got the man with the best body who works with him, so you got 2.5.
Yeah, and Calvin Harris.
He only beat you by 0.5. Well,
I got five.
He definitely wasn't five. I'm going back to the archives to find that.
I wouldn't mind, I watch The Chase every day. I'm trying to kind of like learn all this shit. But I did fucking crap there.
Sure, look, it's just a little
it's
bit
trivial
at the end just to take us off her.
Yeah, you can edit that bit out.
Yeah, I will. Keith, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on today, and I really enjoyed this. And your tour now for the rest of the year, I probably won't get to see you again this year.
You can come over with Jay and catch a couple of the shows.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a good night out, isn't it, Jay?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a predominant female audience, you can't go wrong.
I'm looking forward to it.
Cheers, brother. Nice to see you.
Bam, bam, bam.
Oh.